Good morning. My name is Diana Diggs, and I'm a member of the Music and Worship Committee. And we were asked by Anne to address the question, she says, in our efforts to understand and not lose connection with those who think differently than we do, it can be very difficult to decide whether to keep fishing or cut bait. My short answer to that question is, come to the corner of X and Y and bring your kaleidoscope. Let me tell you what I mean. To tell you what I mean, we need to revisit Anne's sermon briefly, especially if you were not here 2 weeks ago. She gave a really interesting packed sermon entitled When My Rock Is Not Your Rock, and it's what a friend here calls a juicy sermon. There was lots to unpack, lots to mull over. Among other things, she looked at the historical roots of a tension in Unitarian Universalism between our attachment to individualism on the one hand and our need for institutional stability on the other. And in general, we tend to be a lot more interested in the former, the individual, and kind of indifferent maybe to the institution. We know that it's good for us, but we hope that it just kind of takes care of itself. Then she looked at how that historical tension between the individual and the institution, how that maps with a liberal conservative spectrum of moral values. And you might remember, if you were here, that she painted a picture of an X and Y axis, and you have the Y axis here, the X axis horizontally, with these six values that she described to us. And in the corner of X and Y is the value of care or harm. And at the other end is liberty or oppression, and in between were things like loyalty, sanctity, authority. UUs are very, very interested in the values in that corner, care and fairness, I think was the next one, and they're very interested in the one at the end. But the ones in between, we're not so comfortable with loyalty, group identity, nationalism, patriotism, and so on. Conservatives, according to the research that she was using, conservatives are much more equally invested across all of those values. So their bar graph doesn't look like ours. Ours is very uneven and theirs is less so. And the end result is, as she said, just look around our world. We find ourselves on different rocks from other people in society or even in our own families, our neighbors. I recommend reading the whole sermon on the website because it is quite rich, but for our purposes today, the key point is that so-called good people can end up on these very different rocks by virtue of following different moral values. And the rocks feel foundational to us. They feel solid, right? They feel like they're, we rock sitters, we sort of think of them as vaguely universal and that these values are tethered to timeless ideas of right and wrong. I mean, things like justice or fairness, sanctity. Can't we all agree that fairness is beyond religion and politics, or that sanctity, the sanctity of the body at least, bodily integrity, that that's beyond religion and politics? But as she told us, pointed out, reminded us that in some periods, like the one we're living in right now, that's not true. Nothing is outside of religion and politics. So here we are, we rock sitters. Do we fish or cut bait? If we don't see any stepping stones to these folks on other rocks, do we fish or cut bait? And can you trust your heart to know when to do that and how to do that? But I have to say, for better or for worse, for the most part, I have to admit, I am not good at cutting bait. Even the binary framing I find very difficult, and I prefer the metaphor of the kaleidoscope. Can I stay on my rock and hold my ground, so to speak, but give the kaleidoscope a turn? When you do that, different colors come into view, a new pattern emerges. Maybe it changes my understanding, maybe it doesn't. Maybe I stay on my rock, but I see the distant ones a little bit more clearly, or maybe I think about them in a new way. Sometimes this turn of the kaleidoscope is done for us by calamitous events, bankruptcy or medical trauma or divorce or whatever, but I'm talking about the less dramatic ones, the attempts that we as UUs make to try to understand one another. And it's all about seeing, literally seeing each other. And some of you may be familiar with the sacred book of the Mayans, the Popol Vuh, about the problem, the fundamental problem that humans have of not seeing. We don't see others, we walk only at a certain height, we don't spin around, we have blinders, so we're limited. And the Mayans believed that all of us have a double that sits on our shoulder, and this double is able to see way far ahead and beside us and behind us, and in that way guide us on our path and also help us to see other people. So I use this metaphor, the kaleidoscope, for me is a useful metaphor of trying to see more clearly, try to see other people in order to trust my heart. But I found that in doing that, I found that turning the kaleidoscope a turn or two often makes it more complicated, makes the moral values that I share, that other people espouse or demonstrate, they're more complicated. Sanctity, fairness, all of those things that I thought might be so simple are actually more complex. Let me give you an example, and maybe there's some people here who were at the movie Friday night. There were a number of TPCers from the Racial Justice Task Force, a co-sponsor of this film at JP Forum called This Ain't Normal. It's an amazing film about the gangs in Boston, the hundreds, literally hundreds of gangs that are restricted not just by area, but by street. They are so hemmed in by competition between these gangs that it's like having checkpoints around you in your daily movements. And the movie recounts the efforts by a pioneering program called the Street Safe Project of street workers who are trying to get these young men who are at risk of living or dying, that's their binary, it's not cut or fish bait, it's am I gonna survive or not. The street workers are trying to help them see what small steps they can take to get out of this sort of binary situation. And what I find interesting is that they go to the corner of what I call X and Y, where that fundamental value of care, or its inverse, harm, where care resides, and they try to help them see a way out. Because for these guys, all the moral values that we've been discussing the past couple of weeks in Anne's sermons, these values are almost irrelevant. The one that holds power is the one in the middle called loyalty or affiliation. Sometimes it takes the form of nationalism or patriotism. In this case, it takes the form of a group identity that literally is the difference between life and death for them. So the street workers, in their attempt to try to get them out of their situation, they might talk to these young men about their future. And in one very powerful scene, the guy is talking to somebody who can't even imagine anything but this binary of live or die, loyalty to the group or not. It's not about staying in the hood or getting out, it's about surviving. So the street worker says, I thought you were going to be an electrician. I thought you were going to work in the union. He tries to plant these seeds of possibility in the young man's mind. The young man says these things, and he says them so tentatively. It's like a very bad actor trying out a script. But he keeps saying it, and as he does that, as he deals with these ideas that were previously unimaginable, he begins to flesh out the picture. He says, yes, I'm going to be an apprentice in 5 years. Yes, I might have a daughter. Yes, I might be able to take care of her. He starts seeing these things. So in a way, the kaleidoscope is shifting just a bit for him to make his possibilities more complex, that it's not, do I fish or cut bait? Do I stay in this neighborhood or do I get out? It's about acquiring the skill to see more possibilities. At that corner on our XY axis of care or harm, we've also seen some surprising action lately from our mayor, or maybe not action, but words at least. Most of us know about Marty Walsh and his dramatic, I shouldn't say dramatic, but poignant descriptions of his experiences in the recovery movement. And as a recovering alcoholic, he's kind of a binary guy. I mean, it's you drink or you don't drink, you use or you don't use. There's not a lot of room in between. So when public health advocates are pushing for injection sites, for example, Marty Walsh was initially very, very indifferent or very reluctant to embrace that. But the more evidence that he looked at, the more information that he got, the kaleidoscope shifted, and he saw it. It's not that the pieces weren't still there, the pieces of a drug addict, addiction, illness, risk, and danger, but the pieces of the kaleidoscope reassembled so that he was able to see harm reduction. That harm reduction trumps all of these other ideas, all of these other values of authority or tradition or the law. So he's at the corner, he comes to the corner of X and Y where you can practice care and reduce harm. FGM, female genital mutilation, is another example. Very widespread practice still, and public health people have been condemning it for years, for decades, massive amounts of education, and it's still remained very, very persistent. Where have we seen progress? In the West, with immigrant communities from some of the countries that practice FGM, their doctors are in a dilemma. Do they fish or cut bait? Do they do something that they know is unethical, brutal, and in some cases illegal? Or, for those doctors who come from the same communities, do they shift the kaleidoscope and find a way to deal with it differently? And there's a doctor actually in Boston, I think, who's done just that. She has reimagined the procedure as almost a symbolic one, but it allows the people who go through with it to reenacting the same sorts of ceremonies and social rites. It allows that person to not experience the harm of being shunned or shamed by her community. So she's neither harmed by the practice of FGM or the daily misery of being shunned and shamed by a community that believes in the value of that. So again, this is an example of somebody at that intersection of X and Y practicing care and reducing harm. UUism is a really good place to think about these things because we like to hold many truths, to use our jargon. We like to hold many contradictory things at the same time. And we're more at ease with layers and circles and spirals, I would say, than we are with straight lines. And that to me is a kaleidoscope image. We sift through all of these contradictory realities in our free and responsible search for truth and meaning, one of those most cherished of our seven principles. And when we do that, yes, it can be confusing, it can be paralyzing. But when it is, and here we're going to mix up all the metaphors, you're on your rock, you have your fishing pole, trying to decide whether cut or bait, and I say just clutch that kaleidoscope, give it another turn, maybe two, before you come back to the corner of X and Y, the most fundamental place where we can practice care. It's at the point, that's the point on the grid where I feel like our common humanity really leaps up to make itself felt. And it's the safest place, I think, where we can trust our heart. I'm not in any way suggesting a kaleidoscope of equal possibilities or anything like that, just the kaleidoscope as a metaphor that I have found useful to get me to that place where I can trust my heart. So perhaps you have a different metaphor that helps you, and if it does, I hope you will share it. Thank you.
Trusting the heart to know. A few days ago, when Jennifer B. asked if I could participate in this morning's service and speak on the topic of trusting the heart, I replied that I might not be the best messenger for this message, since I have long advocated the importance of skepticism about even one's most cherished beliefs. Indeed, years ago, I gave a sermon here at one of the lay-led services whose topic was, feeling sure is not the same as being right. An axiom I still hold to be of crucial importance. When NPR revived the This I Believe project, where people were asked to submit a 500-word essay on their most important beliefs, my contribution was, I believe in doubt. In my teaching, I strive to hold to the Socratic tradition with my students, always pushing them to question and keep asking, how is that known? Not only what is the answer and why is that, but what else could it be and why is it not that? I think we as humans have great capacity for self-serving, self-deception. And I have sometimes argued that a good part of the entire field of statistics, for example, is mostly a careful accounting method to make it more difficult for us to fool ourselves. The Enlightenment philosopher David Hume argued that reason is the slave of passion. The heart wants what it wants, and all too frequently can bend our reason to make its desires seem just incontrovertibly right. We can see this historically in some of the horrible, cruel things that people have done to one another in the spirit of righteousness. We can see it personally in our own lives. Almost all of us can remember some things felt and done in high emotion where now the best we can do is look back with a rueful, it seemed like a good idea at the time. As I reflected on this, though, I realized that although I am wary of the transcendent feeling that something is just right, the feeling that something is wrong is, in my experience, very dependable. There has been a good deal of anatomical attribution here, what with going with my gut and following my heart, so I'm not sure to which organ I should attribute the sense that something is not right. In my imagination, I see the little wavy lines that emanate from the head of Peter Parker, no relation to Theodore Parker so far as I know, when his spider sense is tingling. Both in the Spider-Man comics and in real life, it is always a very good idea to pay attention to this sensation. Regular readers of the love letters columns in the newspaper will be very familiar with the situation where some advice seeker, addled by romantic infatuation, is barreling toward disaster obvious to everyone but them, and the readers collectively shout at the newspapers, no, 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 don't go there. Whereas when someone writes in, I don't know, this just doesn't seem quite right, the Greek chorus of readers replies, darn well it's not right, often followed by, dump the bum. This is the time to trust what the heart knows, but maybe trying to hide from the conscious mind. The sense that something is wrong is almost always right. Frustratingly, though, it is often maddeningly unhelpful at identifying just what it is that is wrong. When I was working as an emergency room doctor during doing the graveyard shift at our local community hospital, one of my clinical rules of thumb was that when a mother brought her child to the hospital saying that something was wrong, she was invariably right. Even if all the test results were normal, and even if the mom's own theories about the exact nature of the illness were not medically sound. Similarly, in interpersonal relationships, the feeling that something is off is nearly always important, even when it can be almost impossible to pin down exactly where the problem lies. Is it you? Is it me? Is it the situation? Or some strange tangle of all of these? Even when we can feel in our heart that there is a problem, we are often poor at locating the source. We see this perhaps most disturbingly in abusive relationships, where the abuser projects their feelings onto the abused, blaming them for the problems. Both aspects are important, I think. Trusting the heart when it is telling you that something is wrong, but remembering that we can be mistaken about just what that is. So, my message then is to be skeptical of the heart when it says, this is right, since it conflates desire with truth. But pay close attention when it says, this is wrong, at the same time acknowledging that exactly what is wrong can be hard to figure out. Sometimes it is them, sometimes it is us, sometimes some combination. All that said, I realized working through this that a good number of people here in this church have been rejected and sometimes wounded by the church of their upbringing, which told them that what their heart felt was wrong. I consider myself undeservedly fortunate that when this happened to me as an early adolescent, it never really occurred to me that there might be something wrong with me. This church is messed up, I thought, and I am out of here. Trusting what the heart says about love, I believe, is essential. At the same time, I hear abusive people talk about what they are doing as being motivated by love. And although I feel certain they are wrong, I do not have a simple, clear guide star to distinguish the good from the bad. The best I can do is to attend not just to my feelings, but to the person whom I am having feelings for, and outward from there to the network of connected hearts we belong to. So yes, trust the heart to know more and deeper than the mind alone can know. But beware of the feeling that this is right, paying heed instead when you sense that something is wrong, since this is almost always right.